This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martoreno. You're invited to join us each and every week as we discuss with experts in the behavioral health field, fostering diverse and meaningful conversations on substance abuse and mental health. That's what Recovery Radio is all about. And we've got a good one for you today. It is a combination of a success story about substance abuse, struggling, and then ultimate sobriety, coupled with how that translates into what our guest's work is now regarding helping others who have faced this problem in their life as well. Darnell Hinton is our guest on the telephone. Darnell is a young fellow, as I said, who's got his own story of substance abuse and then the work that transpired as a result of his struggles. So if you have the time and want to get informed about this broad area of behavioral health, which of course includes mental health issues as well as substance abuse, then hang around for Recovery Radio today. Darnell Hinton, welcome to the program and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me. I appreciate being on here with you.
So let's talk about you and let people know your backstory. Where are you from? How old are you?
So I'm 28 years old. I'm from Norristown, Pennsylvania, which is about 15, maybe 20 minutes outside of Philadelphia.
So tell us about your background. How were you brought up? Children, your siblings. Let us find out about you.
I grew up in Norristown, Pennsylvania. I have one younger brother. I have one older sister. My older sister, her name is Lamara, and then my younger brother's name is Darius. We all grew up in Norristown, Pennsylvania. Grew up with both parents in my household, very, very closely knit family. I don't want to say strict, but my mom made sure that, my parents made sure that we were well taken care of growing up. We always had what we needed, I guess, as kids. Like we didn't necessarily need for anything. But we didn't necessarily have the most either. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if anyone listening knows necessarily where Norristown is. It's not necessarily the biggest area in the world, but it is an interesting place. Not the nicest place in the world, but as I mentioned before, my parents made sure that we didn't necessarily need for anything as kids. Could we have had more? Yes, but mm-hmm. they did a great job masking that and making sure that we had what we needed as kids. So.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting about that is that you have described a kind of working class background that a lot of people can relate to, and it doesn't sound like it was in any way dysfunctional or grim in the way a lot of stereotypical behaviors might. Come to mind. People think everybody who has a problem with substance abuse had some kind of wretched upbringing. It's not always the case. As far as your hometown is concerned, Norristown's like every other, every other working class, blue collar kind of neighborhood. You're right. It's made up of all kinds of people with all kinds of different lifestyles. So the family was, it was solid. You weren't raised by a bunch of crazy people. Was there a lot in and around you growing up, though, was there a lot of drug use and drinking that you were aware of as a youngster?
So I would say I wasn't exposed to much drug use until I was in my teen years. So I grew up going to public school. I went to public school my entire life until I got to high school. And the reason for that was, as I got to my teen years, 13, 14, 15, my parents started noticing that as I was becoming a man, I was, starting to branch off and hang out with people who weren't necessarily doing drugs or dealing drugs, but maybe the environment that they lived in or the environments that we were socially hanging around weren't the best environment. So that's when I began getting exposed to, I guess, people who were abusing drugs, not directly, but indirectly, being at some of my friends' homes and seeing people at that time with which we did not know, you know, what was going on. We just seen them as people who looked a little different than us. Mm-hmm. We didn't know how to identify it until we got a little older. Then we figured out, like, these people are, they're coming in the house for 2 seconds. They're leaving out the house in 2 seconds. They come back in an hour. They're coming in the house for 2 seconds. They're leaving in 2 seconds. You know, what are these people doing here? Right. And we started to put two and two together and realize that, you know, their parents were dealing drugs and these people were on drugs. And then in an effort to get me out of that environment, my parents sent me to Catholic school to try and send me down a better path.
Yeah, let's pull back a minute. So while it wasn't immediately a part of your life, you certainly were in an environment where it was going on. With regard to your personal use, you say you gravitated towards a kind of a rougher social group. What were you guys up to? Was it just standard, you know, young people experimentation? Did it begin with marijuana? Give me a kind of framework of that personally for you. What was it like?
Personally for me?
Yeah.
So personally for me, I was very much a late bloomer. So, like, I'm that stereotypical kid where if you ask someone, if you told someone my story, they didn't know, they would say, someone who knows me personally would say, no, not, you know, I've never in a million years would expect that to happen to him. So I don't think I smoked weed my first time until I was 18 or 19. I don't think I had my first beer when I was, I think, maybe a junior in high school. And that wasn't until I went until I got transferred to the Catholic high school. So it started just innocently like any other person, with a blunt, marijuana and a red Solo cup. And then that process, which, like I said, innocently, I had no idea what I was getting myself into at that time. Mm-hmm. But that transpired into my college years. And then that slowly transitioned, into, you know, heavier marijuana use and heavier drinking. And then, that later got me to, my drug of choice, which was opiates, which I never seen that coming myself.
Let's late blooming. You're right. I've spoken to so many people with stories of substance abuse and then recovery, and they very often begin at an unbelievably young age. It doesn't sound like that happened for you. So it happens a little later for you. You were, as you say, the least likely guy of people who knew you who might go down this path. How quickly did things begin to accelerate for you? I mean, you start smoking, you know, even if it, at 18, start smoking marijuana and drinking a little heavily. How quickly did it drop into some, you know, much more serious habit?
So it got serious, I'd say, my junior year in college. So, you know, when I got to college, I was doing what every other kid was doing, right? So going to parties, drinking, smoking, still managing to maintain my good grades and maintain a good grade point average, because that was expected in my household, and my parents weren't expecting or weren't allowing anything less. So I was still maintaining my grades and doing what I needed to do, because, you know, things weren't unmanageable at that point.
Right,
And it was easy for me. But it wasn't until, like I said, I got into opiates when things started going downhill. So I think I tried opiates for the first time when I was 20, I want to say. So I was maybe at the end of my sophomore year, or in the middle of my sophomore year of college. I had no idea what a Percocet was. I had never heard of a Percocet. I had no idea the type of clamps it could put on a person. I had no idea what withdrawal was.
Mm-hmm.
I had no knowledge of any of this information. I just knew that my roommates were doing it. And it made them feel amazing. So what they would say, or what they would tell me, And I had said no for forever at this point. And one day I just, you know, I just gave in and I said, yeah, you know, I'll try one. I don't like the way weed makes me feel anymore. Right. It makes me, it gives me anxiety. I don't like smoking weed anymore. Let me try this and do this to take me outside of myself. And I mean, that opened doors for me that I was not, you know, unfortunately not able to close for the next 8 years of my life.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting about your story. And again, I always say this, that all these stories of substance abuse and recovery are the same, except they're different. Yours is very interesting. You know, late bloomer experimenting with this stuff. You know, the least likely guy to get involved in something like this, and then you wind up with a big serious problem. When you say you know you moved on to opioids because you weren't being satisfied with the substances you were abusing before that, marijuana, maybe drinking. Why were you smoking the marijuana to excess and drinking in the first place for? I mean, the idea that you wanted to move to something else because you no longer felt good about what you were abusing, that mystifies people. Were you fulfilling some need? Did you feel bad and needed to escape? Tell us what was going through your mind as you were stepping up.
So at that point, I guess I didn't even know that. I mean, I didn't know. I didn't know that that I was going through what I was going through. I just thought that I was doing what every other person around me was doing, and you know, that's what I was doing. I was just innocently smoking, or so I thought I was, and innocently drinking because I was at college, and that's what college kids are supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was doing. But later, you know, 8 years later, and a lot of years later, with a lot more wisdom and a lot more knowledge into what actually. And a lot more experience, more importantly, with what actually goes into this and what the disease brings up. Now I know I'm more in tune with why I needed to smoke and why I was drinking is because I wanted to suppress my feelings and put something in me that took me outside of myself. So yeah. I didn't have to think about myself for 2 seconds, and I didn't have to think about the stress and the anxiety that that comes with school and graduating and being successful and getting a job and the stress that bills bring on and everything that life encompasses and everything that comes with that. So, I had no idea, but you know, now I have a better understanding of that.
Well, I want to get into deeper, a little deeper into what you ultimately found out the hard way as we go forward here. Darnell Hinton is our guest. He's telling us about his story with substance abuse and now his sobriety. A bit later, we'll find out his role as president of something called Teach One, Feed One, which is what he's working on right now. We have more with our guest. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Hi, welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano with you. Our guest on the telephone is the president, or I guess founder and president of a nonprofit called Teach One, Feed One, which came out of his experience with substance abuse. We'll find out much, much more about Teach One, Feed One ahead, but we're hearing Darnell Hinton's personal story about his struggles with substance abuse and how he ultimately got sober and joins us today to talk about what's going on in his life. So, Darnell, you're high-functioning, unfortunately, as a substance abuser, which means which is bad news. It's good news, bad news. You're able to keep grades up until you can't anymore. But that also makes it easier for you to hide the problem from your parents. At what point did that fall apart and your parents became aware that you were in trouble?
So for me, I ended up telling my mom because I couldn't handle, I guess, like the stress related with it and everything that was falling apart in my life. It gave me a mental breakdown. But my mom and dad, they did let me know, and they informed me that although they didn't directly say something to me, but they did notice that something was wrong because of their parents. You know, your parents have looked at you every day. I'm 28 years old. They said they've looked at me every day of my life since I was 28. So they knew when something was wrong. But they just didn't know what, because they didn't want to assume, or they didn't want to, I guess, come face the reality that there was something going on with substance abuse. I still remember the day when I went to my mom and I let her know that there's something going on. I need to talk to you. I don't really know how to talk to you about this, but I think I have an issue with substances. I broke down and cried.
What were you doing at that point when you tell your mom you got a problem? What was your habits? What were you doing?
Opiates.
Pill form? Were you?
Yes.
Oh, so it was just pills at that point.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How serious was your use?
So it started with maybe one or two a day, maybe even a half, and then that slowly progressed into two or three, and then that grew to four and five, and then five became eight. But I let her know that I had an issue way before that took off. I let her know, you know, in the beginning stages of my life beginning to unravel. So at this point I had lost a job, and at this point I had began losing relationships with friends, and my grades were beginning to slip, and things were just unraveling at a really rapid pace. And I didn't know what to do. I had no idea where to turn. I had no idea what to do. It's something I've never dealt with before in my life, and I didn't know how to stop. So I just figured the best person I could go to was my mother, because that's who I felt most comfortable going to.
Yeah.
And she said that she would be with me in this, and she didn't really know how to handle it either, but she tried to put on a face for me and look like, or make it appear as if she knew how to handle this, but I don't really think it initially she really knew what to do either.
All right, so what were the first steps you took, you and your family?
So the first step I took was, like I said, I let them know I had an issue, and then we tried to do outpatient. We went to an outpatient facility in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. It's called Rehab After Work.
Mm-hmm.
We tried that because we thought that would work, but I don't think we knew how serious the issue was. And with an outpatient facility, there's really no supervision outside of when you come in and when you leave. So they told me that I needed to stop, but at that point there was no, I needed a detox at that point, and
yeah.
I didn't get that.
Yeah. So, let me ask you about that, because on the one hand, it's understandable. You try to minimize the problem by thinking, well, I can do it. I can do my recovery methods, you know, at a lesser level. I mean, opiates are serious. You were addicted to them, no doubt. When did you realize that you needed to be detoxed before you could begin the actual process of straightening out?
So I guess I realized that once I got to treatment. Because I didn't know how serious the issue was, but I knew at that point that once they told me to go to IOP, I knew I couldn't stop on my own. I never had been to detox, so I didn't really know even, I didn't have a understanding of what detox was at that point until I went. So, I didn't even really know what treatment was. I knew there was rehab, but I didn't know what to expect once I got to rehab. So once I got there, it was like a culture shock. It was a shock for me. I didn't know what I was walking into at all. So
let me stop you for a second.
At that point.
Let me stop you for a second. But so prior to this, you didn't have any serious experience with withdrawal or you never overdosed?
So no, at this point, no, I had not overdosed. And I mean, if I'm fast forwarding, I actually never did. I was lucky enough to never overdose, but I did have experience with withdrawal. I did. But I'm saying that I had such a lack of knowledge of what even withdrawal was that I didn't really even know what I was going to. This is going into my first time entering treatment. So I didn't even really know what withdrawal was at that point. I just knew that I didn't feel right. And then getting around more people who were using and hanging around more people who were using, then they offered me and told me that, hey, you can take this. This is Suboxone. It'll make you feel better. You're going through withdrawal right now. Then I had a better understanding of what withdrawal was. And then at that point, once the IOP didn't work because I was sneaking out, after I would go to group and I would still go get high because I knew I wasn't feeling well and I was going through withdrawal and failing urine tests when I went back. At that point, it was when my parents said, hey, we think we need to move you into an inpatient facility where you can't do things like this.
All right, I want to pick up on that when we come back. Darnell Hinton is our guest, telling us about his struggles with substance abuse and where they have led him now to sobriety and some good, good work with an organization called Teach One, Feed One. This is Recovery Radio. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We will return to our guest, Darnell Hinton, straight ahead, but I want to remind you what the mission is of Recovery Radio, and that is to inform and educate you about a wide range of behavioral health issues. That's what the program's about. Now, our sponsor is, of course, Retreat Behavioral Health. They are a world-class organization, but they're dedicated to, as I said, informing and educating. I give you their phone number, and I say this all the time, too. It's our hope you never need to call them, but as you could hear from our guest today and many other guests we've had, when this disease hits, there's a lot of denial, there's a lot of lack of understanding. There's very often nowhere to turn. The people at Retreat Behavioral Health are there to answer the questions for you. If they can help you, terrific. They've helped a lot of people. So I give you the phone number. And again, any questions about anything you've heard today or any questions in your life about the wide issue of behavioral health, mental health issues, as well as substance abuse issues, they'll answer your questions. 855-859-8808. That's 855-859-8808. Retreat Behavioral Health. Darrell Hinton, Hinton has been talking to us about his story of substance abuse and his eventual recovery. So, Darnell, you realize that you can't do this incrementally. You need a much higher level of care. You get yourself into a residential facility. You get detoxed. How successful were you there? How many were you in and out of treatment? Give us a little thumbnail of that.
So, yes, I was very much in and out of treatment. And just to let you know, give you a perspective into how much or how little knowledge I had of treatment and what actually addiction was and how the disease operates. I went into treatment to Retreat. I was supposed to stay for 30 days. I ended up staying for 14 days. I had so little knowledge and I had so little of a grasp of what actually addiction was that I thought that when I was asked what program I was going to use when I got out, I went to a sober living home in Lancaster. I lived on Queen Street. And my roommates asked me if I wanted to do NA or AA. I told them that I was going to do NA because alcohol wasn't my problem and that I still planned on drinking. And they explained to me that, you know, especially living in a sober living home, that's definitely not the way it works. You have to be sober completely. But, you know, altogether, even if you don't plan on living in a sober living home and you want to do this from your home or from wherever else you want to do this from, this is all, it all encompasses one disease. And, whether you do NA or you do AA, it really doesn't matter if alcohol is a problem or not. You shouldn't drink because it's all one disease. So my plan was to still continue to drink NA because I thought that I had a drug problem and that I thought that you know, I was still going to go and drink after that. And it wasn't until some years later that I finally got a better understanding of that.
When does that moment occur to you? Because, again, this is a fairly typical progression. You know, if I stop doing this, I can at least do that. You're making deals with yourself. Well, I can't get off of everything, and maybe if I just do this, I won't have to do that. When did you – I mean, I'm sorry. You said how many times you were in and out of treatment?
I've been to treatment 9 times.
9 times. A lot of people hearing that go, my God, 9 times. When did you sort of – turn the, when did the light go on? First of all, why did you keep trying? That's a question I ask a lot of you. Why did you keep trying, Darnell?
Keep trying to go to treatment, or keep trying?
To get sober. When did you, why, you know, nine times people would go, gee, this isn't working. Why did you keep going?
I mean, because each time I went in, I genuinely wanted to stay clean. I wanted to stay clean for myself. I wanted to stay clean for my family and my parents. I wanted to stay clean for my girlfriend. I just genuinely couldn't. Genuinely couldn't. I mean, maybe out of the nine times I went, one time I wasn't serious. You know, one time I went and I was using in treatment. I had people bring me stuff and sneak stuff in the treatment. And I wasn't, I guess, serious about it. But the other eight times I was completely serious, and I had full intentions on staying clean. I just couldn't stay clean. When I got out, life hit me. Because when you go to treatment, you're in a bubble, right? So you're, kind of away from society, and there's no bills, there's no rent, there's no car, there's no job, there's no, cell phone bill, or, you know, any outside or exterior stressors that you have to deal with. Mm-hmm. So, but once you leave, you know, everything hits you at once, and you're back in real life, and you have to pay rent, and you're in debt now, and you have to figure out that, and you have to figure out how you're going to, you know, make up for lost times. And now you have to get a job, and now you have to deal with life itself. And it all kind of comes back at once. And it's I mean, at least for me, it was stressful enough, you know, for me to just say, you know, screw this. I'd rather just not think about any of this. And I'd rather do something that's going to take my mind off
right,
of it.
Just stay, and, just stay high. You know, as you say, as a, you know, a hard worker at this, you characterize your trips in there as only one being not serious and the other eight being very serious, nevertheless, not succeeding. Talk a little bit about how that just added to the stress. Every time you failed, you were aware that you failed, and you had let yourself down and everyone else. That must be a pretty heavy load.
Absolutely. So, you know, I knew in my mind each time I went in that I wanted to stay clean. I think some of my family knew, deep down in their heart, they knew that I wanted to stay clean each time I went in. But, you know, perception is reality too. So,
You
know, people only know what they see.
Yeah,
so you go in and you come out and you don't stay clean. Then you go in again and you say you're going to stay clean and you come out and you don't, you go in again and you say you're going to stay clean and you don't, and people start, your word starts meaning less and less, and people start, believing in you less. And, you know, although I had the best intentions and although I wanted to stay clean, I knew I wanted to stay clean. And like I said, some of my close family and friends, I think they knew at their core that I wanted to stay clean. They only knew what they seen. So they knew that I told them that I was going to stay clean, and then I came out and I didn't stay clean. So now my word meant less and less to them. And now, you know, things became less, you know, less valid, and, it kind of hurt their trust, and it kind of, they've kind of felt betrayed, as if like I was betraying them.
Right. And, you know, you're aware of this. I'm sure that your family hung in there with you, because many families in a similar situation look at the constant failures in and out of rehab and wonder whether you're really serious about this, until they become aware of the nature of the disease. Do you remember when everybody sort of got on the same page and going, Darnell's not deliberately doing this, he's got a disease? Do you remember when that sort of came together for you and your family?
Yeah, I'd say maybe, because I mean, if I'm going through this personally, if it's my first time in treatment and I'm going through it, and I have such a lack of knowledge of what's going on that you know, to the point where I think I'm still going to be able to go to NA because I'm still going to drink in NA, and that's like I thought that was acceptable, then you can only imagine the people who weren't going through it, you know, directly, like my close family, how little knowledge they had of what was going on. So I'd say maybe my fourth or fifth time in treatment, maybe a little before, maybe a little after. It wasn't until that point that everyone started doing more research and started going to, I mean, they had to, like on family visits, talking to my counselor and speaking to other families. On the family visits, it was at that point that they kind of got a much more of a grip of what was going on and understood the seriousness and the severity of what actually was taking place, as opposed to just he likes to get high because he likes to get high.
Yeah, there was a much
deeper issue at hand.
In other words, everybody stops blaming external things like, well, we weren't good parents, or he had the wrong friends, or he's weak, and start realizing that if you had diabetes or cancer, nobody would blame you for having them. It was time to look at this as a medical problem. It's the enduring tragedy of this substance abuse disease that even now, after everything we know, people still have a hard time getting their head around the fact that this is a disease and you really don't have a whole hell of a lot of control over it. So anyway, here you are now. You are sober and now have want to take your experience and help solve some of the problems you talked about that you and your family and friends went through trying to understand the disease. So tell us about Teach One, Feed One. How did that come about?
Yeah, so Teach One, Feed One is a nonprofit organization, and what we do is we assist people struggling from the disease of addiction in maintaining sustained sobriety. Our mission is everything we do, we believe in eliminating the stigma attached with addiction. We believe in the innovative thinking, bold actions, and challenging the way that this disease is approached. We work endlessly to humanize those suffering from this fatal disease and decrease the number of families that will experience the horrors mine and millions of other families have. How this came about was, so I like helping people. That's just what I like doing at my core. But I was never really in a position to help people because I never really could help myself. So I was still needing to put myself in a position to do better for myself before I can extend my hand and help others. So it was that combined with a few other things, like me being afraid to fail and me being afraid what other people might think and me really not knowing the first steps to take. So all of that stuff, a culmination of all of that stuff, put together was what was, I guess, stopping me from putting this forward. And then I was actually sitting in one of my groups in IOP, true story, and, our counselor was going around the room just on a Friday, and he was asking everyone what they were going to do that weekend. And I was maybe four or five people away. And I was going back and forth in my head about, should I say it here? Should I just do it now? And, I made a decision up in my mind. I said, listen, I'm just going to do it. And then whatever happened from it, happened from it. So once he got to me, he said, Darnell, what are you going to do this weekend? I said, I'm going to go to Kensington and I'm going to feed the homeless. And then everyone kind of gave me like this weird look like, wow, that's pretty noble. And at that point, I had no plans. Like, I hadn't told anyone that I was going to go to Kensington and feed them. At this point, it was just me. So I had just made up in my mind that I was going to do it. So I don't drive. Like, still to this day, I don't have a license. And I think I had maybe, $38 or $42 in my bank account at this point. And I got home. I told my sister, okay, I need your help. I want to go to Kensington. I want to feed the homeless. I put up a post on Instagram and I said, I'm looking for maybe one to two people to come with me to feed the homeless in Kensington. I had about six or seven people reach back out to me and DM me and said that they would be interested in helping. I collected $5 from each person. We went to Little Caesars. We bought eight boxes of pizza. I think we ended up with seven or eight people. We went to Kensington. We handed out the eight boxes of pizza. We came home. I put up another post thanking everyone for coming out with me. I put up a post the next week and said, hey, I'm looking to go out again this weekend. We're looking to double what we did. We did the same. Seven people came back, and we had maybe three or four more people come out with me. We bought 16 boxes of pizza.
Wow.
And that process went on, I want to say, for the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Darnell, let me stop. I don't want you too far into this thing because I want you to finish this story. It's really is a fishes and loaves story. Darnell Hinton is president of Teach One, Feed One. We're going to let him continue the story of his work with that organization straight ahead. This is Recovery Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We have been speaking with Darnell Hinton, who has been utterly frank about his struggles with substance abuse and his ultimate sobriety, which led him to begin very simply with very little resources and practically no resources, deciding he would quit focusing on himself and go into one of the worst areas of the drug epidemic in the country, a section of Philadelphia called Kensington, and just buy some pizzas and feed some people. As that effort grew and has become something called Teach One, Feed One. Darnell formed that. He is the president of it, and he's telling us about this. So, yeah, I mentioned that I don't want to get too metaphysical here now, but it is a fishes and loaves story. I mean, how does a guy with no money in his pocket and struggling with substance abuse decide he's going to go feed people? You just started doing it, and it grew. How quickly – were you surprised, first of all, at the willingness of people almost immediately to get involved in this?
People, yeah. Honestly – I'm still surprised to this day of how quickly people like gravitated towards what we were doing, and I think it had something to do with the fact that that initially when we first started going down, I said we weren't going to take any pictures, we weren't going to let people know what we were doing. I wanted to come from my heart, and I just want to go down there and I want to see people and leave, because I've been in that position before, and I want to let people know that I've been there before, I've been where you've been. And I want to let you know that someone is here to help you, because there was no one. I wish there were more people here to help me when I was in your position. And it wasn't until someone came up to me and let me know, like, hey, I love what you're doing, but if you really want to help people, I think you need to start thinking of this more as a formalized business. And I think you should start taking pictures of your work and you guys going down and feeding the homeless and letting people know what you're doing, because then people can get behind your mission and people can get behind it and gravitate towards it. But yes, still to this day, it surprises me with how many people and how quickly people started gravitating towards it and assisting us.
It's interesting, again, looking at the story you just told. You are sitting there in group wondering, am I going to make it this time? What am I going to do? And then the idea pops in your head that you just go try to help somebody else in trouble. But it's not about helping them with substance abuse. It's much actually more modest than that. They're not only in trouble with drugs, but they're hungry. So you decide that maybe service is what I should do. I'll just go help people. How therapeutic is that in your mind? It obviously helped your sobriety, right?
Me personally?
Yes.
I think it's the best form of service and the best form of I think it's the best form of service that I've ever done. It's better than, in my opinion, it's helped me exponentially more than anything I've ever done. Mm-hmm. And that includes, it's not to say that NA meetings or AA meetings don't help me, because they do help me and they're extremely helpful in my life. But actually going out and doing the service work yourself, in my opinion, it's been the most rewarding for me.
So, the site now is just loaded with it's got your mission statement, and the pictures that you talk about are there. There are people that you have helped. Look, I don't want to make this. I don't want to blow a lot of smoke here, but it is very inspiring. So among the things that Teach One, Feed One does is you assist people to get into treatment, because they're sitting there and they don't know what to do. They're just grateful for the food, I guess. Then you also assist them in exiting treatment. Tell us a little bit about the kinds of assistance you provide when people are coming out of treatment.
Right. So the things that I spoke on briefly with you, as far as the stressors that led me to use, bills and rent and your family abandoning you. I took all of those things, and we essentially turned them into programs. So we have a program where We will pay someone's rent who's behind on their back rent, just so they're not forced to get kicked out of their recovery house. We have a program where we go and assist a mother whose family has abandoned them and left them just to figure things out on their own. We have a program where we have a developed trade program where someone with a criminal record who may not be able to get a job, normal job wearing a suit and tie every day to work, where we will either provide them with the funds to go and develop a trade. Maybe it's an electrician or a carpenter or barber, whatever that may be, and provide them with the necessary tools and schooling that they would need to go do that. We have a whole bunch of we have a program where we assist people who have accumulated criminal fines and have a whole bunch of fines on their record, where we have completely wiped out all of their fines. And now that person is a legal driver today. So we have plenty of programs that will essentially assist someone who, that may be the reason why they go back to using it, because they think there's no one's there for them. And they have to figure all this out on their own and they don't know how they're going to do it. So that's what our programs are designed to do, is to take that stress away from people.
Darnell, you know what? It's a great story. Congratulations on turning your life around. And obviously, thank you for your work in this regard. Teach One, Feed One. How do people find out more about you?
So teachonefeedone.org is our website. It's very simple. Teachonefeedone.org. The donate. You can make donations through there. You can also find us on Instagram at teachonefeedone. We are also available on Facebook at teachonefeedone. Our email is teachonefeedone@gmail.com. And that is where you can find most of our work.
Darnell, thanks. So, listen, this is one of the best interviews I've done. You're really an inspiration. Good for you and good for Teach One, Feed One. Darnell Hinton, thanks for joining us on Recovery Radio.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Take care, everybody. And I want to, of course, remind everybody that Recovery Radio is here just for this purpose. We hope you've enjoyed this program. And if you or any of your loved one need more information, again, the phone number 855-859-8808 for Retreat Behavioral Health. Take care. See you next time on Recovery Radio.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.